I don't know if there's a parent out there who doesn't, at one time or another, feel like they're not spending enough time with their kids. Or when they're little and they demand constant attention, it's one thing. But as they grow older, it seems as though the time becomes less and less. If you're working, that is, if both of you are working, father and mother, that is, assuming that father and mother are both in the house at some time together, it gets even harder. We have issues like daycare, what to do with the kids when we can't be around. Now, I mentioned before that it sorts for guilt for a lot of parents, and then for others, not so much. And there seems to be an entire culture, an entire industry, bent upon, ameliorating the guilt that parents might naturally feel from leaving their kids alone, either at home or with someone else. For institutionalizing their kids, if you want to call it that, warehousing their children from a very early age. And we're told, some are telling us, this is good for our kids. It'll toughen them up. It'll make them ready for the real world. We're going to talk about the social impact of absent parents during this hour of issues, etc. Feel free to join us. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our guest in this hour to talk about the social impact of absent parents, Mary Eberstadt. She's a research fellow at Stanford's University's Hoover Institution. She's a consulting editor to Policy Review and author of the new book, Home Alone America, The Hidden Toll of Daycare, Behavioral Drugs, and Other Parent Substitutes. Mary, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks very much for having me, Todd.
Mary, you talk about a decades-long separationist experiment, is what you call it, parents exiting the home. Has this experiment been a success or a failure, and what, generally speaking, if you could summarize for us, has been the fallout of such an experiment?
Well, I think if you look at it from the point of view of many adults, it is a success in the sense that adults are now more free to separate from their children without stigma than they ever have been before. But if you look at it from the point of view of many kids, I think you get a different answer, and that's what my book, Home Alone America, is about. That fundamentally, there's a paradox out there. We are better off, generally speaking, than we ever have been in history. And yet, at the same time, this very well-off, materially well-off generation of kids has problems that their parents' generation and other generations did not have. Each of these problems gets a chapter in my book. For example, child obesity, we all know from reading the papers, has tripled since the early 1960s. There's an epidemic of sexually transmitted disease among teenagers. There's a skyrocketing going on with mental health numbers, you know, psychiatric problems. Everybody who's around kids or schools knows this. Behavioral disorders, conduct disorders are all apparently on the rise with no explanation for why coming from the medical profession. And also, of course, we're using lots of psychiatric drugs to treat kids. Now, I think if you look at these phenomena, you see that there's a common denominator, which is these problems are growing in a world in which many kids are more separated from their parents and extended family than they ever have been before. And that's what my argument is about.
Now, there are many who are arguing on the other side nowadays, Mary, who say, look, if you track these kids, and now we have several decades of kids who have come through daycare, behavioral drugs, all of the things that you've talked about, and largely absent parents, both of them are working and outside the home, often throughout most of the daylight hours. They say, look at these kids. They go on to college. They go on to good careers. It doesn't look like they're really any worse off. How do you respond?
Well, there is the saying, children are resilient, and yes, they are. You can do all kinds of things to them. Children can grow up with extreme deprivation. They can grow up poor, they can grow up without any parent at all and still turn out fine, and all of that is true. And for that matter, I don't think that daycare does long-term harm to most kids or even many kids necessarily, but I think when we only look at outcomes like that, we are coarsening ourselves to what's really going on here, because the question isn't always, look, are they going to hold down a job 20 years from now successfully? The question ought to be sometimes, what are they experiencing in the here and now? What does an infant or toddler who's separated from mom, dad, home, siblings, 12 hours a day, feel about that? Should we pay attention to their feelings about things like that? I think if you look at the popular culture of this generation, and in particular its music, which I have a whole chapter on, you see that from the point of view of many of these kids, there really are not enough loving and protective adults to go around. So when we start talking about outcomes, it seems to me we shouldn't just look at the outcomes on paper, you know, how many kids graduate and how many don't become drug users and things like that. I think we need to look at other kinds of outcomes than the kind that we have tended to look at over the past few decades in trying to judge this experiment.
I found your chapter on the music especially enlightening there, having a teenage daughter myself and being familiar with a lot of the music you're talking about vicariously through her. You seem to say that the kids themselves, the kids who have gone through the absent parent experiment, are well aware of what they've been put through, and they're connecting the dots to their plight. Is that true?
Yes, thank you, Todd. Let me tell your listeners about that chapter. I also have teenagers, and I sat down and listened for several days to a lot of the best-selling music in America. I mean bands that your teenagers would recognize in a heartbeat, like Everclear and Blink 182 and Korn and Nickelback and Tupac Shakur and lots of other bands I could name. And above all, Eminem, who of course is reviled by most parents. What I found in listening to this music is that if you push past the violence of it and the profanity of it, which I admit is hard for some of us to do, there is a common thread running through it that I found quite surprising, and it's the thread of the feeling of having been abandoned as a child. Every one of those bands that I've just named resonates with kids because every one of them has songs about growing up in a broken home or feeling like they never saw enough of mom and dad. And it's a very sad set of themes that this music is plumbing, and I don't think most adults are aware of it. It's interesting, Todd, when I go around and talk about the book, whenever there are people in the audience or the studio who are under 30, they just nod when I start talking about what's in the music because they know. And they know all of this is true, but their parents' generation, the baby boom generation, the Gen Xers, they had a very different kind of music. So the way I formulate the distinction in my book is to say, if yesterday's music, the baby boom music, was the music of abandon, today's music is the music of abandonment. And I think if you sit down and listen to it, you'll be surprised at what you find. And it will also tell you something about what a lot of today's kids go through.
You mentioned before daycare. What's the real trouble with daycare?
Well, you know, I always have to stress that this isn't a finger-pointing book. We all know people who have to use daycare, right? And we also know that quality varies widely in daycare centers. So this is not an attack on the folks who use daycare. It is an attack on a certain other kind of folks who have been arguing for years that this kind of care is as good as or superior to maternal care. The basic problem with daycare is that I had several decades of cheerleading for the institution have led us to disbelieve the evidence of our senses. What is that evidence? The evidence of our senses is that little children, babies and toddlers especially, want to be with their mothers, want to be at home. And we have coarsened ourselves against this truth with a lot of ideological happy talk about how they need daycare to be socialized or they need to buck up and toughen up. The basic problem with daycare is that it raises the risk that kids will be sick and unhappy. And I go through some of the studies verifying those claims in my book.
Now, just give us the scope of what daycare can mean in a worst-case scenario, not in terms of the quality of care, but in terms of the time spent there by children, some of them practically newborns.
Well, I think we're all aware, if you live around centers, that the age at which kids are accepted has been pushed down pretty far. I think they do take kids from 6 weeks up. And again, my point is not that surrogate care is always bad. As I say in the book, I have four kids. I couldn't exist without surrogate care myself, in various forms, and families have always used surrogate care. My point is different, that we can't invoke a truth like that to justify the kind of extended separation that goes on routinely now. Many children are separated from their parents and their homes for most of their waking hours. Is that a good thing? Well, it depends on what you're looking at. If your idea of a good thing is something that won't hurt them when they go to the job market in 20 years, I guess it doesn't matter. But from the point of view of that child, and again, this is what my book tries to do, is get the adults off the stage and just zero in on the child's experience. From the point of view of that child, I don't think that's an optimal outcome. No matter how many educational toys he has and how much material benefit.
We're talking about the social impact of absent parents with Mary Eberstadt. Now, the best callers and emailers during this hour as we discuss this will receive a copy of Mary's new book called Home Alone America. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Oh, by the way, please include your first name and the city and state in your email, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Mary, you also talk about, and this is the term itself struck me, feral humanity. We usually talk about feral animals, animals that have been left on their own out in the wild, and they go wild. Give us some examples of what you're talking about.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Todd, because in some places people seem to think that my book is very controversial. In other places, people just shrug and say, well, you know, this is just common sense. And I think a lot of it is. About the subject of feral children, I'll give you an example that I thought was quite striking from one of the chapters. In 2003, Time magazine reported the results of a study of daycare and lower school kids in the Fort Worth area. And I think there were something like 39 schools and daycare centers surveyed. And the striking finding was that over 90% of the principals and heads of these places said that kids were worse behaved, we're talking about five-year-olds here, and more violent than they had been even 5 years before. Now, when they were asked why they thought the kids were worst behaved, what they said was very interesting. Kids are not getting enough lap time. They're not seeing enough of their families. They're not seeing their families at the dinner table. As one teacher put it, how can you expect kids to get through a school day when they haven't learned, you know, even a minimum of how to behave at home because they don't even have to spend 5 minutes a night with their families at a table? In other words, if you talk to the folks on the ground about what's going on out there and what the problems are with kids, especially little kids, they all say the same thing. They say, look, it's not the teachers. The problem is that they're not being civilized at home and they're not seeing enough of their families. And when the teachers say that, that's not judged to be a terribly controversial thing. So I don't think it should be too controversial to say it in a book. I also think that teachers have a really hard time these days and that they've gotten something of a bad rap because, you know, they're held responsible for these kids for more hours a day than they used to be and for kids with more behavioral problems than they used to have. So you have to hand it to the teachers and say, you know, if they come up with an explanation for what's going on out there, whether it makes people feel guilty or not, maybe we ought to listen to it.
Why do you think it is that when there are these, say, a school shooting, Columbine it comes to mind, why do you think it is that, generally speaking, when all the postmortem, and no terrible pun intended there, is done on something like this, and the analysis is done of the kids who did this, why is it that the absent parent factor is so often ignored in something like that when it seems to be a prominent common denominator?
Well, I don't think there are many subjects more sensitive than the question of how you take care of your kids. And I think we all feel that. Parents, first of all, feel natural guilt about all kinds of decisions. And they really ought to, in the sense that to be a mother or father is to be responsible for somebody else's life day in and day out. And, of course, you're going to get some things wrong. So parents are very hyper-aware and sensitive to begin with. But, you know, I think there's something else going on out there, which is that we have three trends now which are intersecting to create what I call the absent adult home. We have working motherhood, which is sometimes a real choice and sometimes not. Working moms out there, please know that I am not bashing you. I have dedicated this book to a working mother, my own working mother, who was a nurse. But that is clearly a trend that takes a lot of moms out of the house a lot of the time. We also have, just as important and maybe more so, the phenomenon of divorce, which is very widespread. About half of all kids will grow up in a home without their biological father. And we also have a third trend that nobody's looked at. Families are smaller. The extended family is smaller. A lot of kids don't live around grandma, grandpa, you know, older siblings and aunts and uncles who used to pick up the slack for a lot of the stuff I'm describing in the book, including just plain supervision. So we have these three trends, which are all the result of human creation. These are conscious decisions that people have taken, and they're intersecting in a way that isn't very good for kids. Now, the problem is that these trends are all the consequences of adult freedom, and adults naturally don't want that freedom curtailed. So this is also a longer way of saying why this is such a sensitive subject. I don't think as a society that we want to reexamine making divorce harder to get, for example, or reexamine the phenomenon of working motherhood. We want to think these questions are settled. I think that the problems with kids today show that they are not settled from the point of view of the kids, but the adults may have a different answer to that.
You lay out this scenario, Mary, wherein, let's say we're in a daycare or in a elementary school, kindergarten classroom. A little boy is tired and he has a fit. You know, he just falls down and he's shaking and crying on the floor, as little boys will do. Kind of a normal thing for a tired kid. The next thing you know, the teacher's recommending Ritalin for this kid. Under any other circumstances, and in particular the home, might have been considered a normal tantrum, is considered kind of a clinical problem at that point. Tell us about this.
Well, I think this is a very important feature of reality for kids today. You know, when people say life is better for kids today than it ever has been, well, you can talk about how they have a lot of extra Game Boys and, you know, leisure time and video games and great shoes and all this kind of stuff, brand name clothing. But the truth is also that today's kids don't have something that those of us who are adults enjoyed. They don't have the sense of just being normal kids. The bounds of normality have been shrunk by our psychiatric professionals and by other people. And what I mean, let me be specific, is that behavior that a generation ago would have been regarded as normal, like being antsy in school if you're a six-year-old boy going into your seventh hour of it, or certain kinds of aggressive play on the playground, again, if you're a boy in particular. These sorts of things have been redefined as psychiatric disorders, as disorders of conduct, which is to say that a lot of what's going on in the psychiatric diagnoses is what would have been considered normal behavior not very long ago. Now, why is this happening? My hypothesis is that it's not just that kids are around adults less and less. It's that adults are around children less and less. And I think the less they are around children, the more bizarre and problematic and annoying children's behavior appears to them. And this is something I wish the medical profession would talk more about, because there has been a striking redefinition of what it means to be an abnormal child. We are now including millions more children in these categories than we used to. Now, I'm not saying that some kids don't have terrible mental problems. Obviously, they do. And, you know, for that matter, if you want to talk about the psychiatric drugs, I know a lot of families swear by them and think that they help. But the issue isn't the hard cases of the drugs or the disorders. The issue is that we're including an awful lot of other kids in these categories, and even people who believe, for example, that psychiatric drugs like Ritalin are good also believe that we are over-diagnosing these cases. So there's not a lot of argument about that. What I'm trying to get at is, why are we over-diagnosing them? And I think, again, that the adult world is becoming less sensitive to children.
With only 30 seconds here, Mary, are there long-term consequences that we can track for this over-prescribed generation of kids?
Nobody has looked at that yet, and somebody really needs to, because I think the biggest cost is likely to be the psychic cost of what it means to these kids to be told from a very early age that there's something fundamentally wrong with them that they need medication to correct. And that's something that our social scientists aren't looking at now, but they ought to.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest. We're talking about the social impact of absent parents on Issues Etc. during this hour. Feel free to join us. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers and emailers will receive a copy of Mary Eberstadt's new book called Home Alone America, The Hidden Toll of Daycare, Behavioral Drugs, and Other Parent Substitutes. That email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. The phone number again, 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to call in anonymously, because sometimes this is a sensitive subject as well. I was looking at the backside of the book, by the way, and P.J. O'Rourke, one of my favorite authors, wrote this, and I want you to think about this, folks. Considering what we said so far with Mary, if you don't think that Mary Eberstadt's arguments have merit, make this experiment, writes O'Rourke. Try treating your dog the way America treats its kids. Give the puppy her own set of house keys and leave her alone all day. Put her in front of the TV instead of taking her for a walk. Let her eat anything she wants and house train herself. Send her to another master for visitation on weekends. And when she comes into heat, turn her loose in the pound. We're going to talk about some of the other social impacts of absent parents. The list does go on when we come back from this break. Our call-in number is 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I started this conversation talking about the guilt that every parent feels when they consider how much time they're spending with their kids. And a lot of us have bought into that myth that it is quality, not quantity. You know, maybe what our kids are looking for is quantity. Maybe what they're looking for is more FaceTime. Not necessarily great FaceTime, just FaceTime with mom and dad on a regular basis. What the real danger of this is not so much in whether or not we'll feel good about being parents at the end of the day. The question is, how will our kids do today and tomorrow, and how will they be raising their children? Consider that while we talk about the social impact of absent parents. 1-800-730-2727 or our in-studio email address. For the best callers and emailers, a copy of Home Alone America, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc. How is the Old Testament prophet Joshua a type of Christ? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. This commentary focuses on the faithfulness of God, how He kept His covenant promises, and how these promises are fulfilled in Christ. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse on our website at issuesetc.org. Read about the history, culture, and archaeology surrounding the Promised Land in this Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The cost is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer and praise on real-life changes in India. Christians raised at the Ramabai Mukti Mission are giving hope to women and children who would otherwise be cast off in society. Here are some examples. Tara is a woman who has a ministry to the deaf, where 40 boys and girls are learning computer science, and they're learning how to be tailors. Another woman, Sharadini, tutors young children in a community where there are few Christians. She has regular opportunities to share about Christ. Meanwhile, another person named Rachel and her husband have started several centers to care for abandoned children in the city of Mumbai. Pray that these ministries through the Ramabai Mukti Mission will continue to prosper. Read more inspiring stories of gospel breakthroughs with a free magazine on India from Mukti. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Welcome to February. Until 450 BC, February was the last month of the year. The name comes from Latin, februa, the Roman feast of purification. Romans used February to clean up their accounts with the gods, a kind of end-of-the-year spiritual 1040. That there was a concern about atoning for wrongs 1,000 miles from the Hebrew prophets and their scathing calls to repentance, and that there was a repentant urge long before hellfire and damnation Christian preachers, suggests that we humans have in us something instinctive about straightening out our accounts with the gods, or the God. Many people ignore that urge, which makes sense to me if the gods, or the God, are vengeful. Why punish yourself now with repentance if the gods, or the God, will punish you eternally for your sins? Eat, drink, and be merry. But if the gods, or God, intend repentance as a kind invitation to reconciliation, to forgiveness and life, then this February, with Ash Wednesday and 27 other days, can be a welcome time. God, be merciful to me, a sinner, prayed one man to the true God. Whoever comes to me, I will never drive away, is the answer of his son.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois. Christ Our Savior is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. The Reverend Bruce Kaseman is the pastor. Their phone number, area code 618-539-5664. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, an Issues Etc. underwriter on AM 850 KFUO. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. You can help support Issues Etc. It's talk radio for the thinking Christian by joining our monthly donor program called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. To find out more about the Reformation Club, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, and help us reach our goal of 125 Reformation Club members by Easter this year, issuesetc.org. Mary Eberstadt is our guest. We're talking about the social impact of absent parents. She's written the new book called Home Alone America, The Hidden Toll of Daycare Behavioral Drugs and Other Parent Substitutes. On the issue of obesity, and you observe in one of your chapters that an outsider's view of America upon returning to American culture is that we have fit parents and fat kids. We have amply answered the question of how kids become obese. You say we have not answered the question of why they become obese. Answer that question for us.
Well, what the first thing you have to understand about child obesity at today's levels is that the conventional explanations for it don't hold up. You can't blame just Colonel Sanders and McDonald's because we've had fast food in the country for a long time. You can't blame big food for this problem. It's also true, of course, that a lot of adults are getting fatter too. This is not just an issue in America. It's an issue all over the world in advanced industrialized countries. So is child obesity in countries like France and England and Canada. So it's not just us. But the why of it, I think, is very obvious, and that is the fundamental reason why kids get heavy is that there is no one there to stop them from putting food in their mouth. There's no one there to supervise their diets. If you look at the way a lot of kids live today, you can see that the absent family, absent parent problem contributes to child obesity in two ways. Number one, we have latchkey kids. Their job is to go home after school and throw the lock and stay in their room or basement until an adult shows up. That is to say, they're getting no exercise after school. And, of course, we all know no exercise contributes to heaviness and obesity. And the second connection is, once again, in the matter of who is supervising what they feed themselves. A child will normally go to a cupboard and eat 10 cookies instead of two, at least my children will, if nobody's around to tell them to stop. And having parents out of the house in those late afternoon hours obviously contributes to children overeating. So does having kids in these aftercare programs after school, because there's no one running these programs with a long-term interest in the child's health. In fact, the short-term interests of the caregivers often run the other way, because their immediate interest is to see that the kids are temporarily happy. And one way to do this is to give kids lots of sugary sweets. I know there must be a lot of moms and dads out there who know this from leaving kids with a babysitter, because babysitters, no matter how beloved, will typically give kids more sweets and cookies and snacks than parents would. So those are at least two ways in which not having enough moms and dads around, especially I think in those critical after-school hours, obviously contribute to childhood obesity. I can name you one more that I think is very important, and that's the family dinner hour. Now, that might seem paradoxical to say that we reduce child obesity by sitting down and eating food together, but it is true that when people eat alone or eat in front of a television, that they eat more and they eat faster than they do if they're having a conversation and sitting around a table. Many homes, we know, are too harried and hectic to have this kind of family time, but it turns out to matter not just for obesity, but for other links to other kinds of behaviors, and we can get into that later. There's been a lot of research on what eating dinner as a family can do. I'm drawing a specific link here to the question of child obesity and saying, look, since a lot of kids are just eating without anybody around and with nobody to talk to and overeating because of that, obviously trying to reintroduce family dinner time might be a good thing for them. And interestingly, the government of France, which is very concerned about its childhood obesity problem, is urging just this solution for French people, too.
On the issue of teen sex, you have your optimists on one side, who point to the fact that the number of babies born to teenagers has been on a steady decline over the last several decades. You have your pessimists on the other side, who point to a hyper-sexualized culture that our kids imbibe of quite often and with very few restraints. Yet you say that the optimists have the real story about teen sex dead wrong, and even the pessimists don't realize how bad the situation really is. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that if you look at medical studies of the kinds of diseases going around for kids, it's impossible to read those studies without being seriously worried about what's going to happen to a lot of today's teenagers. The optimists want to say that just because the pregnancy rate is falling, that goes to show that kids are handling sex just fine and that they're being responsible. Well, obviously, one reason the pregnancy rate falls is that you have abortion on demand, and if you don't think that's a good thing, then you wouldn't necessarily infer that the falling pregnancy rate is a good thing either. Birth rate. But in any event, the sexually transmitted disease problem is major, and it has medical professionals alarmed across the country. It is an epidemic, and that word isn't mine. That's the word of President Clinton's Surgeon General, David Satcher, who wrote the introduction to a large authoritative study on the subject, which hundreds of medical professionals signed off on. What kinds of diseases are the kids getting? Well, this is a very unfair epidemic. It's worse for girls than for boys. they will get certain viruses linked to cancer of the cervix, for example. They will get stuff that will make it hard for them to have babies down the road. There are lots of details in my book about this. But the bottom line is, well, sometimes people say, yes, Mrs. Eberstadt, but what does this have to do with parents? Well, it is kind of obvious that if parents aren't around to supervise teenagers as much as they can, teenagers are arguably more likely to do all kinds of things, like smoking and drinking, and yes, sex is one of them. This fundamentally a commonsensical point has been confirmed by social science. I cite a study in my book that draws a very clear line between homes that are empty in the afternoon and likelihood of kids having sex. Obviously, the easier it is to have sex, the easier it is to spread the diseases around. Parents can't be everywhere. Kids will go to parties and, you know, some teenagers will find a way. But my point is that nothing could be simpler than the connection between supervised teenagers and teenagers who have a harder time having sex and thereby contracting diseases.
And this issue of disease, just so that that does not in any way get lost on our listeners, this issue of disease, the rise of STDs of all kinds among teenagers, kids, is, you use the word epidemic, that you said that's not your word. Can you give us just an idea about where we're at?
I'll give you a statistic that comes from the Centers for Disease Control in a study done in 2000, estimating that there were 19 million new cases of sexually transmitted disease in that year, and that of those cases, fully half, whatever that is, 7.9 million, sorry, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but half of these 19 million cases were in kids and young adults ages 15 to 24.
Our email address here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. If you have a question or a comment on the social impact of absent parents, we're talking with Mary Eberstadt, author of the book Home Alone America, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Mary Eberstadt is a research fellow at Stanford's University's Hoover Institution and a consulting editor for Policy Review. 1-800-730-2727. Here's an email from Lisa in Houston, Texas. This is what she says. I keep hearing that kids need quality interaction, not just quantity. How can you have quality interactions if you have to introduce yourself because you're not around enough? Mary.
Well, that's a very good question, and unfortunately it does describe a lot of homes. You know, what I've always thought was problematic about this idea of quality time was that I have read experts saying that if you cuddle up with your three-year-old for 15 minutes and read a story at night, that's quality time. Well, anyone who's around children knows that those are exactly the hours when they're at their lowest. In other words, the time when they're at their best and most lively and fun and interested in the world is the time when a lot of them are away with caregivers, you know, in daycare or what have you. So the idea of quality time is problematic for more reasons than one, but that's just one of them.
Lisa from Houston, email us your mailing address and I'll send you a copy of Home Alone America by our guest Mary Eberstadt, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Nathan from Minneapolis writes this, has there been any criticism of your book that surprised you, and what might your next project be?
That's very kind. Criticism that surprised me. Well, I was being interviewed with a feminist on the other side, and yes, I was surprised when she lost her temper and started shouting that people like me are the kind of people who had women burned as witches in the Middle Ages. So I would say that was a surprising critical response, and she also went on to say that people like me wanted to bring the Taliban to America. Those were two surprising critical responses. But in general, I would say I anticipated a fair amount of a certain kind of criticism. There's been almost no factual criticism of the book. That is to say, particular facts have not been challenged, which I find rewarding because it means I did my double-checking well. There's been a certain amount of emoting, you know, just people who see the book cover, Todd, I don't know if you described it, but it's
it's brilliant.
Well, it's gotten me into a lot of trouble, but I'm not responsible for it. Authors never are. There's a picture on the front of a mom walking out the door with a briefcase and a boy clinging to her legs. And a lot of people have just drawn a line at that and said, I can't look at that. I just hate that. Well, in fact, if you flip the book over, you will see the same thing, only it's dad's leg and the little boy clinging to dad's leg. And the point of those pictures is just to signal to the reader that this is actually not a book about mom or dad. We've had lots of books about mom and dad. This is a book about something different. The only face you see on that cover is the face of that little boy. And that's what I'm trying to zero in on, whether he's a 2-year-old in daycare or a 7-year-old whose teachers are recommending Ritalin, or a teenager who's unsupervised maybe a lot more than he ought to be. I'm trying to get at his experience.
So here's the polemical, you call it the polemical Trump card, and I'm sure it's already occurred to some of our listeners. All right, while you might be able to illustrate a coincidence between, say, obese children and the amount of time their parents are out of the house, or the rise in STDs among teenagers and the amount of time that we're spending away from our kids, or, in fact, the increase of behavior-altering drugs and the amount of time we're spending away from home as parents, coincidence does not make for cause. So maybe you're drawing a false causal connection. How do you respond?
There are people who would not believe a causal connection existed if the entire RAND Corporation, with the resources of the federal government, spent 20 years connecting all the dots on this. In other words, there are people who will never be satisfied by the data we have, because that's their way of getting out of the argument. But part of what I'm saying is that we don't need a longitudinal study showing exactly what percentage of the increase in obesity can be linked to absent parents. We have the evidence of our senses. We have the reason we were born with. And a lot of people can see the connection between children who are unsupervised and children who will indulge in any number of temptations because they are unsupervised, whether it is overeating or sex or drinking. I want to get back to the example of the family dinner table, because that also raises the question of cause. A study by the Council of Economic Advisers a few years ago got a lot of publicity. It showed, after examining some 7,000 kids, that kids who eat dinner with a parent at night are something like half as likely to smoke, 3 times less likely to take drugs, et cetera, et cetera, that there were correlations, as you'd say, between their behaviors and the fact that they eat dinner with a parent. Now, some people would say this doesn't show any causal connection at all. These are just correlations. But I look at that and say, you know what this shows is that somebody is there, that parents, somebody is at that table, and the mere presence of an adult in that house is keeping certain things from happening. And I think that is the link that we haven't talked enough about. In other words, parents don't have to be perfect. They don't have to lay out the good china. They don't have to buy the right educational toys. A lot of what they need to do, to judge by the social science we've amassed, is just plain be there. As a parent myself who's very imperfect and fallible, I find that a liberating message, not an oppressive message. I think parents have a lot of anxiety about what they're doing, and, you know, they think they need to do all these things from sing to the baby in the womb and, you know, jumpstart their cognitive development in all sorts of ways. But I don't think that the evidence suggests those are the things we ought to be directing our energies and attentions to. I think the evidence suggests that a lot of what kids need is just plain showing up, you know, the showing up of an imperfect parent. And again, I think that is a liberating, positive message to get out of Home Alone America.
1-800-730-2727 is our call-in number. Steve is on the line calling from his car. Steve, thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for joining the show. Just curious about, and I tuned in a little bit late, maybe you've already touched on this, but in your research, whether you found how much the impact was on the husband in the family, kind of pushing the wife back into work because he didn't want to give up the second paycheck or the lifestyle where the, you know, mother actually wanted to stay home with the kids. Have you seen, you know, who's actually driving, you know, getting mom back into the workforce?
It's a good question,
Steve. It's a very good question. I have not seen actual studies of that question, but I certainly know anecdotally from doing a radio and interviews that this comes up frequently. Moms call in and say, you know, I really wanted to stay home, but my husband really wanted me to go back to work because that made things easier for him. I think there's a lot of that going around, and obviously there are women who have to work who have no choice at all because they don't have husbands around. But when people say that I'm too hard on the working mother in the book, I always draw their attention to the fact that the book is probably even more about absent fathers and the role of the father in the child's life, which I think a lot of us, a lot of social science has underestimated, and the kinds of problems we're seeing with kids, again, the loneliness in their popular culture, that is actually more about the dads than about the moms. So dads have a big role to play here. You know, we live in a world where divorce is common. I mention in the book that my own parents divorced when I was young. And there are a lot of dads out there who I would like them to get the message out of the book that, you know, they may feel like they've been written off in their kid's life, but even if they're not physically there, if they could try to be there a little bit more, maybe some of these problems would be ameliorated. Maybe if divorced couples knew that their kids need both parents around, they could work out their differences a little bit harder. So those are the kind of practical realities that I hope come to some small extent out of the book.
1-800-730-2727. Joe is on the line. Joe, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello.
Hi, Joe.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
They got my grandson on that Ritalin. And the reason they put him on there, he's a very active boy, and he can't keep his attention in class. Why do they do that?
Joe, thank you very much. Can you enlighten Joe there, if you would, Mary?
Well, yes. Once again, please understand I'm not attacking the drugs per se, but what I'm saying is something different. I know there are a lot of doctors and teachers and parents who think that the drug helps with attention. Well, one reason kids need more attention is that they're spending longer hours in school and away from their families. And that forgiving home environment is one in which they might be able to behave in a more relaxed way than they can in school. So I'm just saying let's look at maybe why they're acting up in the first place. Maybe their days are a little bit too long. Also, on the subject of Ritalin, you know, it is amazing how many more kids are on it now than used to be. Ritalin production increased 700% in the United States between 1980 and 1990. The rate of prescriptions for all the psychiatric drugs are going up quickly and going up quickest for the 2 to 4-year-old set, which some people might just find frightening. So I think it is legitimate by now to ask, what social purpose are these drugs serving? Is it that these kids wouldn't act as badly if they were around their families more?
Very quickly, Ken, let's do this in bullet point fashion. You say that there's kind of, we're not being entirely honest here. When we say that children are resilient, what do we often mean by that, Mary?
Well, the way that phrase is used, it means that it's okay for us to split up or divorce, not get married in the first place, you know, let mom pursue her career rather than spend more time at home. In other words, it's always used in one direction only, which is to justify what it is that adults are about to do or want to do. And I'm saying, yes, it's true that children are resilient, but that doesn't justify doing anything we want to them, including leaving them alone more than is good for them.
We say that it takes a village to raise a child, but what do we ignore when we say that?
Well, that in any real village, a child has not only mother and father, in any real village, that child will have other people in addition to his mother and father and not instead of his mother and father.
And when we say that teenagers are rebellious, what do we often mean by that?
We often mean that there's got to be some reason that we can't be blamed for why we haven't seen ours in several weeks or haven't had more than a grunted conversation with the kid in headphones. In other words, we need to spend more time with them especially.
In the end of your book, you say that you are pretty much lacking in soundbite solutions to the problems that you have diagnosed in the book. You call rather for what you term a new public consensus. What is that new public consensus?
That it would be better for children and for society at large if more parents were able to be around more of the time. It doesn't mean that every woman is strapped to the oven and has to stay home. Doesn't mean that every unhappy couple will be forced to live under the same roof. But I think the evidence strongly shows that from the point of view of a lot of kids, there are not enough loving, protective adults to go around, and life would be better for them if they could see more of the adults in their lives who fit that description. And that, again, resonates with common sense, I think.
Mary Eberstadt is a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, a consulting editor for Policy Review, and author of the new book, Home Alone America, The Hidden Toll of Daycare, Behavioral Drugs, and Other Parent Substitutes. Mary, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you so much, Todd. I enjoyed it very much.
And the caller, Steve, call us back if you would, and I'll send you a copy of Home Alone America as well. Isn't it amazing that a book about, or even raising the subject, having a conversation about parents spending more time with their offspring, the fruit of their loins, their children, would be considered controversial? What, parents spend time with their kids? Don't you know how busy we are? Don't you know we have paychecks to earn? Don't you know that we have activities? Don't you know we need a little time to ourselves? Well, you know, all of that is true. We do have ways that we are called upon to spend our time all the time. Work and career and the obligations that take us out of the house. This isn't so much about where we're spending our time. With whom we are spending our time is probably most important here. How best to spend our time? That's the question here. I find it amazing that the conversation, a conversation like this on parents spending time at home with their children would be considered controversial. But this is where we're at. We're at a point in our culture where parents apparently have an obligation greater than their children. Now, the last time I checked, the very definition of the term parents would belie that assertion, don't you think? That part and parcel of being a parent is making one's first priority, whether you be at work or anyplace else, one's first priority, one's children. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172.